reach places where the geologists had always wanted to go, maybe NASA would think twice about canceling them. But at the Space Center, it seemed everyone was too caught up in the recovery from Apollo 13 to consider such schemes. Now, in the fall of 1971, Schmidt pushed for Tsiolkovsky again, this time to generate renewed public excitement for Apollo. But it was no easier to sell the far side now than it had been the year before. The satellites added a new level of complexity to an already risky enterprise. Most of all, there was no money for them. Cernan discussed the idea with George Lowe and Chris Kraft and was told it wasn't going to happen. But Schmidt kept pushing until Kraft told Schmidt to stop talking about it. Tsiolkovsky's secrets would have to wait for the next generation of lunar explorers. No matter. The geologists had found a place that could only be described as the jewel in the crown of Apollo landing sites. It gained this status during Apollo 15, when Al Worden flew over the southeastern shore of Mare Serenitatis, the Sea of Serenity, which forms the Man in the Moon's left eye, and saw a whole field of small cinder cones down there. His verbal pictures of tiny volcanic craters, whose conical shape seemed a dead giveaway, were a summons to exploration, but the real clincher came when the film from Apollo 15's panoramic camera was unreeled on light tables at the Space Center, and the geologists could see with their own eyes what had so excited the lone astronaut. Some of those craters lay within a small box canyon ringed by the steep-sided peaks called the Taurus Mountains that formed the worn, ill-defined rim of the ancient basin. 17 miles to the northeast lay the crater Littrow. What was so striking about the valley of Taurus Littrow was its floor, which was covered by some of the darkest material seen on the moon. It seemed entirely out of place, appearing as it did among the light-colored highland terrain. Whatever it was widespread. The geologists found it all along the southeastern portion of Mare Serenitatis. They even spotted patches of it on the high elevations of some of the mountains. How had it gotten there? On Earth, that can happen when pockets of volcanic gas suddenly find release at the surface, spraying molten rock high into the sky. If the same thing had happened on a very intense scale on the moon, it could have blanketed a wide area with volcanic ash. The coating probably wasn't very thick. On Worden's pictures, the rims of small impact craters were clearly visible poking up through the dark mantle. Because it was so dark, the geologists surmised the deposit hadn't been exposed for very long to micrometeorite rain. Otherwise, it would have become faded by being mixed with the soil. Perhaps it was only 500 million years old. After the disappointment of the Descartes Highlands, here was new reason to hope that the moon hadn't died geologically so long ago after all. At the same time, the valley walls, and in particular two rocky prominences christened the North and South Massifs, might finally give a look back to the time before the Imbrium impact, whose influence had yet to be fully escaped. Everyone agreed that the Serenitatis Basin had formed before Imbrium, and hoped the massives would contain the oldest lunar rocks yet found. And there were still other lures, a probable landslide at the base of the South Massif that would undoubtedly contain a rich variety of samples from the mountain, a scarp that resembled features called wrinkle ridges commonly seen on the Maria but never visited, and the sculptured hills, whose knobby shape set them apart from the massives and sparked renewed hopes of highland volcanism. Geologically speaking, Taurus Littrow was the most complex site yet, worthy of the full capabilities of the J mission. Here, in one place, lay the possibility of exploring the beginning and the end of lunar history. But getting there wouldn't be easy, primarily because the valley was only 4.5 miles across from one rocky wall to the other. The normal target ellipses, the ones that showed possible trajectory errors, spilled up onto a mountain on one side of the valley and a landslide at the other, but that was because the ellipses were very conservative. Perhaps the engineers had never gotten over the fact that Armstrong and Aldrin had landed 5 miles past their aim point, because the planners had never changed the size of the error ellipse, even though the next 4 lunar modules had set down within a few hundred feet of their targets. One of the men involved in the site selection process, Jack Sevier, made that point to the trajectory experts, and they soon came back with a smaller ellipse that fit neatly within the valley. Now it was up to the managers. At the site selection meeting, Kraft and McDivitt flashed a thumbs up, as if to say, "It's the last one, let's go for broke." In part, the geologists chose Taurus Littro because they knew Jack Schmidt would be there to explore it. But before he and Cernan could turn their combined geologic prowess on the valley, they had to get there. Schmidt had no unease about becoming the first of his chosen profession to practice on another world, but he knew he must not turn in anything less than an outstanding performance as a lunar module pilot, not just for the sake of the mission or the lives of his crewmates, but because he was nothing less than a test case for all the scientist astronauts who were waiting for their chances to fly. Before he could be a geologist, Schmidt would have to be an astronaut. And on the afternoon of December 11th, when he and Cernan stood side by side at the controls of the lunar module Challenger, descending into the valley of Taurus Littro, the transmissions that came down on the Earth-Moon airwaves were the same jargon-rich shorthand that had been the soundtrack to each of the five previous lunar landings. Schmidt's concentration was total. Except for a glance at the moment of pitch-over, he did not look outside. He did not see the dark valley opening before them, its white mountain sentinels casting long, pointed shadows. He did not see the smooth place just near the crater Poppy, Tracy Cernan's nickname for her late grandfather, where Cernan planned to set down. When he heard Cernan say, "I don't need the numbers anymore," Schmidt knew his commander was getting ready to take over from the computer, but he did not know that there was a boulder field out ahead that Cernan had to maneuver around. At last, 60 feet above the moon, Schmidt took another brief look and reported, for the benefit of his listeners on Earth, "Getting a little dust. Very little dust." Then he returned to the instruments, unaware that Challenger's spindly shadow had appeared on the dark plain, moving toward them, now passing under them. "Stand by for touchdown," Cernan called, and Challenger crept down the last 25 feet. As soon as Schmidt saw the blue contact light come on, he called it out, and after a moment of free fall, he felt them come to a stop with a firm thud. Even as Cernan took a moment to exult, "Okay, Houston, the Challenger has landed," Schmidt was reading checklists and flipping switches. Later, he would jokingly complain he had missed the whole landing. Monday, December 11th, 1972, 6:08 p.m. Houston time, 4 days, 21 hours, 15 minutes mission elapsed time. "Hey, who's been tracking up my lunar surface?" The answer to Jack Schmidt's question was Gene Cernan. Now, with characteristic irreverence, Jack Schmidt was climbing down the ladder to make his own tracks in ancient dust. And when he was at last standing on the valley floor, the end of a journey that began in Flagstaff 8 years earlier, his thoughts were on the significance of the moment. Not to himself, but to humankind. What had brought Schmidt to NASA and had fueled his fanatical drive toward lunar exploration was his devotion to history. He didn't need to be told that he and Cernan would only scratch the surface, that the real exploration of the moon would be left to the ones who would follow them here. How many years, or even decades away that was, Schmidt had no idea. He knew only that the space program was in serious trouble. But Schmidt had a kind of stubborn optimism. He would not give up hope. "Boy," said Cernan, "your feet look like you just..." Schmidt finished the thought. "Walked on the moon? Well, I tell you, Gene, I think the next generation ought to accept this as a challenge. Let's see them leave footsteps like these someday." And for a moment, as he took his first steps, Schmidt's gaze went to a landscape unlike any he had ever seen on Earth. The massives rose like flattened pyramids into the velvet sky, their sides impossibly steep. They had neither the hewn granite sharpness of the Rockies nor the smooth, glacial roundness of Norway's fjords, where Schmidt had done the research for his doctoral thesis. He was looking at mountains that dated back almost to the formation of the solar system. Out on the dark plain, he saw rolling hills, their fluid forms littered with boulders ejected from the larger craters. In the near field, he noticed small, rimless hollows in the soil, the center of each miniature crater marked by a dark spot of fused glass. At his feet, soil and broken rocks sparkled in the unfiltered sunlight, their textures and subtle hues amazingly vivid, their crystals iridescent. On the surface of the larger cobbles, he saw small white spots where micrometeorites had blasted tiny craters. Everywhere he looked, on every scale, his eyes found new detail. He said, "A geologist's paradise, if I ever saw one." Around him, light reflected from the distant mountains and nearby slopes penetrated the shadows. In the southwest, his gaze was arrested by a sparkling blue gibbous earth hanging over the South Massive. He said nothing. 6:41 p.m. It was only natural that Jean Cernan had come to know Jack Schmidt well. The two men had been living in each other's pockets for 16 months. Cernan felt a kind of fatherly responsibility for him. He had gotten used to Schmidt's outspoken manner and his penchant for going to management with a pet issue. Like Dick Gordon, Cernan had learned to keep Schmidt from getting out of hand. They'd developed a great working relationship in the simulator and in the field, but Cernan could not say that he really knew what made Schmidt tick. Schmidt was hard to get at. As outspoken as he was, he kept his emotions well guarded. Cernan was probably one of the most gregarious astronauts, but Schmidt was undoubtedly one of the most private. Before simulator runs, Cernan and Evans would be gabbing with the instructors. Schmidt would be off in a corner with the training manuals. Cernan could certainly tell that Schmidt was excited to be here. In between his expert descriptions, the basic bright-colored rock type in the area looks very much like the cristobalite gabbros in the Mare basalt suite. Schmidt was broadcasting his excitement in snatches of song. Selections included "Bury Me Not," "On the Lone Prairie," "What Is This Crazy Thing Called Love," and "We're Off to See the Wizard," and horrible puns. Informed by Capcom Bob Parker that his suit temperature was running a little high, Schmidt responded, "I'm just a hot geologist, that's all." But underneath all that brashness, was Schmidt absorbing this experience on a personal level? During the past several days, Cernan had hoped Schmidt and Evans were taking it all in for themselves. The night launch was a sight to behold, even before they lifted off, as he could feel the Saturn V's engines coming to full power. Cernan glanced out through the little window in the boost protective cover and saw the glow, and though only he could see it, he said, "Look at the light." In Earth orbit, knowing they would be leaving only too soon, he'd made sure his crew saw the sunrise, and yesterday, just before the lunar orbit insertion burn, Cernan had glanced out the command module's hatch window and had seen what he had never witnessed on Apollo 10, an enormous crescent moon bathed in sunlight, only 8,000 miles away and growing larger by the minute. In this moment, the moon was neither the forbidding hole in the stars seen by Bill Anders, nor the ghostly earth-lit sphere that had greeted Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins. He remembered when, on Apollo 10, he and his crewmates were leaving the moon, climbing away so fast that one of them had said, "If we saw this coming in, we'd have to close our eyes." Now he was seeing it. They were making a dive-bombing run on the moon. Shading his eyes from the sun's glare, Cernan could see huge craters, some of which he recognized from 3 years before. The monocular brought him closer. He could see boulders on the crater walls, ridges curving over the bright horizon. He tried to convey to Evans and Schmidt how unusual it was to see this view. As they drew closer, it grew to fantastic dimension, then disappeared into blackness as Apollo 17 headed for lunar orbit. Cernan would not forget these sights, and he would talk about them for the rest of his life. In his core, he believed it was important to come home with more than just rocks. Now, loading the rover with supplies, Cernan looked up from his work and saw the Earth suspended above the South Massive. No one had ever seen it like this, so close to the horizon. That was because Taurus Littrow was so far from the geographic center of the near side. On the way out to the moon, the side of Earth, like a gemstone suspended in dark water, had held him in awe. It was that sight that brought home the fact that there was nothing at all routine about going to the moon for a second time. the single experience that had made him say to himself, "My God, I'm out here again." Just as he had on Apollo 10, he had watched it turn on an invisible axis, and once again he had consciously asked himself whether he understood what he was seeing. His overwhelming feeling was of a sense of purpose, a gut-level awareness that it was simply too beautiful to have happened by accident. He felt as if he were seeing Earth as it had appeared in the moment before creation, in the mind's eye of God. Now that he was standing on the moon, immersed in the abyss of space, how could the sun shine on him so brightly and not dispel that darkness? He felt as though he were looking out from within a dream, and the Earth was his link with reality. To Cernan, it was the most precious possession a man could hold in his memory. He had to say something. "Oh, man. Hey, Jack, just stop. You owe yourself 30 seconds to look up over the South Massive and look at the Earth." "What? The Earth? Just look up there." "Eh, you've seen one Earth, you've seen them all." It was just like Jack Schmidt to answer his friend's display of emotion with feigned disgust. But in truth, Schmidt had been looking at the Earth for 3 days. Planning to indulge his longtime fascination with meteorology, he'd arranged before the flight to be briefed by Air Force weather forecasters. He'd launched with satellite photos in the pocket of his spacesuit. During the trip out, from the moment he floated out of his sleeping bag, he was broadcasting his observations like a human weather satellite. His descriptions filled pages in the air-to-ground transcripts. "That tropical depression I saw earlier north of Borneo is now even more strongly developed at the tail end of the front that stretches up toward Japan. It really looks like a humdinger from here." The last thing he needed to look at right now was the Earth. He was here to focus on the moon. Not because that was his mission, but because it was his profession, and he was impatient to get on with it. On Earth, Cernan and Schmidt had almost spent less time practicing their geologic activities than the purely mechanical tasks that would punctuate them. Paradoxically, that was for the benefit of the geology work. It didn't make sense, for example, to get on and off the rover at half the pace that they could achieve with practice. By the same token, the men spent hour upon hour laying out their ALSEP experiments so that they would take up as little of the first moonwalk as possible. But on the moon, predictably, those plans went awry. Fortunately, the heat flow experiment was set up without difficulty, giving Mark Langseth his last chance to confirm the puzzling readings at Hadley. But Schmidt was frustrated by another experiment, the lunar gravimeter, designed to show the existence of gravity waves but which now refused to operate. And then there was the lunar drill. Like Dave Scott before him, Gene Cernan was forced into a long, hard battle to obtain a deep core sample. Even the special long-handled jack designed to help Cernan extract the cores seemed to do no good. In mission control, Flight Director Jerry Griffin watched as Cernan, on his knees, wrestled with the jack. With Cernan's heart rate pushing 145, one controller warned Griffin, "He's eating into that oxygen," and urged that Schmidt help him, or we're really going to be in trouble. Cernan was in danger of depleting the oxygen reserves designated for the first geology traverse. Schmidt went over to help pump the jack handle, launching his suited body into space and coming down horizontally on the handle, again and again, interrupted by a tumble that sent himself and pieces of stray equipment spinning into the dust while Schmidt laughed. The flight controller's concern aside, this was the first sign that something was different about Apollo 17. Both men, and especially Schmidt, took to their work with a kind of physical aggressiveness, even arrogance, rarely seen in any moonwalkers before them, and certainly not on the first day outside. They seemed to have no wariness about the risk of a damaged spacesuit. It wasn't recklessness. Both men had a healthy respect for their situation, but the kind of confidence that comes with familiarity, as if they had done all of this many times before. And in a sense they had, because 5 teams of astronauts had gone before them. Once again, the phenomenon of instantaneous evolution that had marked each Apollo mission, not only among the astronauts but the flight controllers and engineers, was at work. Cernan and Schmidt had absorbed the experiences of their predecessors, and now, on the moon, they were building on them. Finally, the moon's grip loosened, and the men had their core. Much to Schmidt's frustration, they were an hour behind the timeline, and Cernan's oxygen consumption had forced Jerry Griffin to cut the upcoming geology traverse short. They would go only half as far from Challenger as planned. Both men had tired hands and sore fingers, but they showed no signs of slowing down. The rover's TV camera caught Schmidt as he bounded back to the lander in crazy cartoon leaps, and once again the airwaves filled with song. "I was strolling on the moon one day," Cernan joined in the merry, merry month of December.
"No, May," said Cernan.
"May is the year of the month." Schmidt laughed.
"That's right, May, when much to my surprise, a pair of bonny eyes."
"Sorry, guys," said Capcom Bob Parker, unable to resist, "but today may be December." Corn on the moon. Jack Schmidt and Gene Cernan weren't letting anything get to them now. They were on an absolute high.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-dee-da-dee.
Tuesday, December 12th, 1:12 a.m., Houston time. 5 days, 4 hours, 19 minutes, mission elapsed time, inside Challenger. The pungent odor of spent gunpowder, that is, the smell of moon dust, filled the cabin as Cernan and Schmidt took off their helmets and gloves. Schmidt knew that on Earth, particles of dust are covered with a thin layer of air, but the dust in Challenger's cabin had never been exposed to oxygen. Each grain was still chemically active, just as gunpowder is immediately after it has been set off, and it reacted with the nasal passages in the same way. Now, to his surprise, he was hit with an attack of hay fever. It had been a long, hard day. Before the geology traverse, Cernan had accidentally caught his hammer on the rover's right rear fender, and before he realized it, most of the fender was gone. As a result, the entire geology traverse was accompanied by a spray of dust that shot skyward and rained down on the two men. They were so filthy that they had spent 15 minutes at the bottom of the ladder trying to dust each other off. Out of their chutes now, the men ate dinner, even though the meal was cold, because the LM had no hot water, it was welcome. It had turned out to be a tougher day than either man had expected. Their hands and forearms ached, their fingers were bruised. Schmidt saw blood under Cernan's nails, no doubt partly due to working with the drill. None of this had dampened their spirits out on the surface. Excitement had pushed all that discomfort into the background. Schmidt's only worry was whether he would be able to accomplish what he had come for. Dick Gordon had once offered him a bit of wisdom regarding spaceflight. Time is relentless. And time had reined in him and Cernan today. Their single geology stop at a medium-sized, block-strewn crater had lasted only half an hour, just long enough to chip off pieces from a couple of boulders and to drag the rake sampler through the hard ground for a bag full of cobbles and dust. He hadn't had time to do much observing. Mostly he had used stolen moments during other work and during the traverses, relaying data from his seat on the rover as they bounced across the dark plains. He had hoped to shed some light on the origin of the dark mantle, but that had eluded him. He still did not know whether it was made of volcanic particles, as the mappers had suspected. Out on the surface, he'd begun to suspect that the mappers had been wrong, that the dark soil might simply be ground-up material from the boulders in the area, which were fairly rich in dark minerals. But the more he looked, the less sure he was. The boulders just weren't dark enough, and if you ground them up, the dust would be even lighter. He hoped there were some experts on Earth who were puzzling through these questions in their laboratories. He would have been happy to talk through dinner about it, but Mission Control had already relayed the questions from the back room and seemed to be letting him and Cernan alone. The moon was throwing him some curves. Of course, that was what his profession was all about. The surprises made it fun. But Schmidt realized that he was in the scientifically vulnerable position of coming all the way to the moon and not learning very much. If something happened and the mission had to be cut short, he and Cernan would leave with a few pieces of basalt. Whatever the dark mantle was, those rocks proved there were lava flows underneath it, along with a few bags of soil, a deep core, and a bit of data from a portable geophysics experiment designed to probe the structure of the rock layers beneath the dusty plain. But that wasn't very much, not compared to the secrets the Valley of Torres Litro still held. 2. Apollo at the Limit.
Nothing was ordinary at Caltech, not even a practical joke. Tradition dictates that one morning each spring, the graduating seniors disappear, leaving their doors locked with high-tech security measures as a challenge to the ingenuity of the underclassmen. On Senior Ditch Day, as it's called, the object is to break into each fortified room, and once inside, if a student is clever enough to get in, he can do whatever he wants. Over the years, this has resulted in some diabolical pranks. A senior returned to his room to find that his furniture had been nailed to the ceiling. Or there was no room at all. The door had been plastered over, painted, and a light fixture installed. Or he opened his door to find a 7-foot weather balloon full of water. This was not a simple problem. He couldn't move it. He definitely did not want to break it. What did the victim do? He broke it. There was a big flood. Jack Schmidt had witnessed many a senior ditch day prank, and so had several people in Mission Control. They decided to awaken their slumbering colleague on the moon with a musical reminder of another hallowed Caltech ritual. Every morning during final exams, at 7 a.m., the students in each dorm would tie their stereo systems together, aim the speakers into the courtyard, and play Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries full blast. Anyone within a mile radius levitated out of his bed. Inside Challenger, the effect wasn't quite as stirring when Schmidt heard the familiar cadence of horns in his earphones, but it did wake him up, and he was glad to be awake. On Earth, Schmidt always needed at least 7 hours of sleep. Unlike Cernan, who seemed to be able to get by on far less, putting in a long day of training even if he had partied the night before, Schmidt assumed the ability to survive on little sleep was an inborn trait of Navy pilots who survived tours of duty on aircraft carriers. Now, even though he had only gotten 6 hours of intermittent sleep, Schmidt felt rested. Thankfully, the soreness in his forearms had disappeared overnight. He would later speculate that the cardiovascular system was so much more efficient in 1/6 G that it cleansed the muscles of lactic acid and other waste products before they could cause any damage. But what lifted Schmidt's spirits most was simply that he and Cernan were still on the moon, that nothing had gone wrong to end the mission, that now they would finally get a chance to explore the valley of Taurus Littrow in earnest. Schmidt was actually more excited today as he climbed down Challenger's ladder than he had been yesterday, walking on the moon for the first time. After repairing the rover's broken fender with some maps, gray tape, and clamps, a fix devised overnight in one of Mission Control's back rooms, he and Cernan headed for the slopes of the 7,500-foot South Massive. There are quite a few places on Earth where you can stand in one spot and see more than a mile of vertical relief. The Himalayas and some parts of the Andes are among them. These mountains testify to the grandest forces on Earth, the slow and steady action of plate tectonics. Since 1967, geologists had come to realize that the Earth's rigid outer layer is divided into a set of interlocking plates that move along on the fluid upper mantle at a speed of a few centimeters per year, about the rate that your fingernails grow. As these plates collide, move apart, and slide past one another, the continents migrate and the ocean floors are recycled. In the process, most of the Earth's major landforms are created. The crust beneath the Pacific Ocean is diving under the west coast of South America, causing massive eruptions at the surface and creating a chain of lofty volcanoes. India is crashing into Asia, pushing up the world's tallest mountain range in the process. But the moon has never had continents or plate tectonics, and the geologists who pondered the origin of the Taurus Mountains looked to the titanic forces unleashed by the collision of the Serenitatis asteroid with the moon. But the details of the cataclysm were still entirely beyond their grasp. Had the massives simply been thrust upward as unbroken pieces of crust, something like the great limestone blocks of Himalayas? That had been one working hypothesis for the Apennines, and when Scott and Irwin saw what looked like hundreds of thin layers on the side of Mount Hadley, it had seemed it might be the right one. But since then, there had been some doubt about whether those layers were real or simply an optical illusion caused at certain angles of illumination. Another hypothesis was that the Apennines and the Massifs were simply piles of ejecta from their respective impact basins. However they had formed, Their Majesty assured that Torres Litro would be remembered as one of the most spectacular places ever visited by human beings. Because the Serenitatis Basin had formed before the Imbrium impact, samples from the Taurus Mountains, beginning with the South Massive today and continuing with the North Massive tomorrow, were the highest priority of the mission. For Cernan and Schmidt, getting to the South Massive meant driving more than 5 miles, the longest traverse ever made on the moon. An hour was budgeted for the journey. Never had so much of a moonwalk been allocated to simply getting from one place to another. Seen from the lander, the South Massive was a seemingly bland face of white-gray stone, but yesterday Schmidt had spotted outcrops of different rock types. No one doubted the trip would be worth it. Tuesday, December 12th, 6:24 p.m. Houston time, 5 days, 21 hours, 31 minutes mission elapsed time. The ride to the South Massive would stand out in Gene Cernan's mind as one of the most exciting times of the mission. Not because of the geology. He didn't have much time to look at that because he was too busy trying to keep from driving into craters. Anxious to save time, he went as fast as he dared, speeding over blind hill crests without slowing down, ready to swerve if a pothole or rock came into view. For now, Cernan left the geological descriptions to Schmidt. It was remarkable, Cernan thought, how much his lunar module pilot could see from the rover as it waltzed along, and how much he brought to bear on his observations. Schmidt was so familiar with samples from previous missions that he actually knew them by number. 7:37 p.m. 73 minutes after leaving the vicinity of the LM, having driven over the suspected landslide and onto a broad scarp, Cernan and Schmidt topped a last rise and descended into a broad trough at the base of the South Massive. Here, a crescent-shaped depression had been christened by Schmidt for the Norwegian Arctic explorer and later statesman Fridtjof Nansen. Now it would serve as the scene for an hour-long geologic assault. Had Schmidt and Cernan been able to look back onto the plains, they would have had a difficult time seeing their lunar module. But here, in this broad, smooth hollow, Challenger and the rest of the valley were hidden from view. This was a place apart from the valley. Perched on this bright slope, Cernan and Schmidt stood at the end of Apollo's longest reach, for Nansen was about as far as two rover-riding astronauts could travel and still have enough time for a meaningful exploration. It would have surprised no one to learn that Jack Schmidt had always felt the planners were too conservative when they calculated walk-back limits, and that before the flight he had pushed, unsuccessfully, to have them relaxed. In any case, the thought of having to walk back to the LM was the furthest thing from his mind. If anything, he felt less at risk here than he had in 1957 and 1958, when he spent 18 months in the fjords of western Norway working on his doctoral research. Working alone in difficult terrain is something most geologists consider downright foolhardy, but they do it anyway, especially when they are short on time, or have no money to pay a field assistant. In Norway, operating on a shoestring budget, Schmidt climbed alone, often making strenuous treks among sheer rock walls. He worked long into the Arctic summer evening, taking advantage of the midnight sun because he wanted to get his money's worth out of the effort it took to get there. But Schmidt knew his own limits, and he saved the really difficult climbs until one of his colleagues from the States came to visit. The unsuspecting visitor found himself dragged off on a grueling ascent into the hill country. On the moon, Schmidt knew, he was far from alone, not just because Cernan was here, but because Mission Control was watching them like a hawk. If either man so much as adjusted the amount of cooling water from his backpack, Houston knew about it, and in his earphones they heard the steady, even baritone of one Robert Allen Ridley Parker, astronomer-astronaut, Caltech Ph.D., and mission scientist for Apollo 17. Parker and Schmidt were more than a little alike. When he wanted to, the quiet, dark-haired astronomer could serve up the same blunt, needling verbiage Schmidt was famous for. The two scientists maintained a kind of disrespectful rapport based on mutual insults that is the coin of the realm at Caltech. The underlying message was, "God, you're incompetent." They really sank the standards when they let you out with a degree. Over the air, Parker maintained a virtual deadpan, but that didn't stop Schmidt from responding as usual. When Parker suggested he take some telephoto pictures of the Massifs if they look interesting, Schmidt set him straight. If they look interesting? If they look interesting? Now, what kind of a thing is that to say? Schmidt knew his friend was in no position to respond in kind. Not with the world listening, and that, of course, gave Schmidt's barbs added bite. But in truth, Parker had not been silenced because he'd inserted little personal touches into Cernan and Schmidt's cuff checklists. For example, at the conclusion of each section there was a message that read, "This is the end, not the beginning." Nansen Crater reminded Schmidt of an alpine valley above the timberline. The craters were smoothed by a blanket of dust that sparkled and threw back the sunlight like new snow. Resting on the surface were hundreds of blocks and fragments which the geologists suspected the landslide had brought down from the heights. He and Cernan had known they would find boulders here because they had seen them on the orbital photographs. But what was their geologic context? Schmidt cast his gaze on the Massif's whitish face. On the high slope, perhaps a full mile above him, Schmidt could see a few thin horizontal bands of color, bluish-gray and tan-gray, the same colors as the rocks at his feet. There was more here than he and Cernan could possibly investigate in the 50-odd minutes allotted. They would have to work fast. It was time, rather than the uniqueness of the lunar landscape, that made this fieldwork unlike any Schmidt had ever done. In Norway, he knew that if he had to, he'd scrape together the money to come back for the next field season. Here, the time pressure was monstrous. The drive for total efficiency ruled. Everything he did was for keeps. 8:07 p.m. At last the mountains of the moon had yielded a rich harvest. Cernan and Schmidt had none of the frustrations that had plagued Scott and Irwin as they searched for boulders on Hadley Delta, or Young and Duke's hunt for the Descartes at Stone Mountain. The time allotted for Nansen was dwindling, raising the inevitable dilemma of whether to exploit a known harvest at the expense of a later unknown one. That decision was left to the two men on the moon. Cernan decided to accept the backroom's offer to take 10 minutes out of a later stop. When Cernan and Schmidt finally headed back to the rover, they had spent 63 minutes at Nansen. Nothing compared to a terrestrial field stop, but one of the longest ever made on the moon. For their labors, the men had made an impressive haul. They would leave the South Massif with an entire saddlebag full of rocks and soil, including a small white fragment spotted by Schmidt in the middle of a gray boulder that would prove to be nearly 4.5 billion years old, one of the oldest rocks ever brought back from the moon. As the rover pitched and rolled its way back down the mountain, a trip that would be just as memorable as the ride out, Schmidt told Parker he felt confident that the blue-gray and tan-gray rocks he and Cernan had collected could, by extrapolation, be linked to the two layers he'd spotted high on the Massif. Parker responded, "I am reminded that extrapolation is the nature of our art." Hearing this admission of imprecision from a scientist, Gene Cernan uttered a slow, forced laugh. 9:20 p.m., Science Operations Room, Manned Spacecraft Center. In the geology back room, Lee Silver studied the television monitor. The pictures from the moon had gotten progressively better with each mission, and the camera's controller, Ed Fendell, had honed his art to the point where he, and anyone else who was watching, could follow Cernan and Schmidt along in their work. Silver could not deny that for himself, Schmidt's presence on the moon gave Apollo 17 a special intensity. He had known Jack Schmidt's father and had met the boy when he was 11 years old. Almost a decade later, he'd lectured to Schmidt at Caltech. Now Schmidt, no longer Silver's student but his colleague, was at work on the surface of another planet. With two J missions behind him, Silver was, in his own words, the old man of this operation. For Apollo 17, he became the first and only scientist to serve not only on Bill Mulberger's surface geology team, but on the overnight planning team as well. He had not slept since Cernan and Schmidt landed, nor would he until they had left Taurus Littrow. But Silver had been under pressure long before now. In the 3 years since he'd become involved with training Apollo astronauts and planning their explorations, The pace of events had been dizzying. The geology team had been designing traverses for Apollo 17 before they had even been able to analyze the rocks from 15 and 16. Silver had seen this phenomenon before. This was classic government science. A federal agency undertakes a massive scientific effort, but is forced by budgetary constraints to press on to new discoveries before the previous ones have been understood. Tied to NASA's mission schedule, the geology team did everything they could to keep up, but Silver, at least, hadn't been completely successful. Some of his Caltech colleagues had developed techniques so sensitive for probing lunar rocks that they could detect individual atoms, but Silver had not had the time or the resources to take advantage of them, and for all the scientists, the slow, painstaking analysis of the samples had lagged far behind the pace of lunar exploration. Some of those samples, Silver knew, contained information that would have affected the planning for each new mission had there been time to learn of it. For example, no one had really analyzed the peculiar green rocks from Spur Crater, which had been on Earth for 16 months. And when this mission was over, the great enterprise called Apollo was shutting down, with so much of the moon left unexplored. And that was also classic government science. If the exploration of the moon had put a professional strain on him and his colleagues, Silver understood that it had also exacted a high cost in personal terms, in strained marriages and disrupted families for people throughout the program. Silver himself had been in a period of great turmoil. His responsibilities at Caltech were crushing. His personal life was rocked by crisis. One night at around 3 a.m. in front of the King's Inn on NASA Road 1, Silver told Schmidt he couldn't keep this up, that he was pulling out of the training program. Schmidt became very upset, and Silver suddenly realized how much the man was depending on him. He decided to stay on, though he was never able to have the same involvement he'd had on Apollo 15. That was the only time in the past 16 months that Silver glimpsed a crack in Schmidt's stubborn armor. Schmidt himself would never admit he felt pressure, but there had been some subtle indications. Silver had seen Schmidt's demeanor change when he made it onto the 17 crew. There was less joking around than when he had been a backup crewman. This was serious business, and Silver knew about the pressure from the scientific community to get him on the flight. He also knew that Schmidt had won his seat at the expense of a very popular pilot astronaut. Silver could not guess at how the other astronauts viewed the decision, but he did sense the scrutiny of the scientific community, who were watching Schmidt and waiting to see whether he would live up to his billing. Some of them, Silver was sure, were probably half-hoping he would screw up. As far as Silver was concerned, Schmidt was doing a beautiful job, and Cernan was holding his own. Early on, some of the geologists had privately worried that Cernan, as a mission commander who enjoyed the limelight, might be reluctant to yield center stage to his lunar module pilot. They had underestimated Cernan's flexibility. Cernan was so accepting of the situation that Silver had felt it necessary to take him aside and encourage him not to let Schmidt be his geologist, in effect, but to be more of a partner, which, having seen Cernan's powers of observation, Silver knew he could be. Watching the pair at work on the moon, Silver was impressed by how Cernan complemented Schmidt's focus on detail with a view of the big picture. But if, at times, Cernan almost seemed to be functioning as a field assistant, "Get your hammer," Schmidt told him at one point. "We're going to need it." That was another measure of this commander's flexibility. The fact was that all through the moonwalks, Cernan had been making first-rate observations, calling Schmidt's attention to intricate fracture patterns in the rocks, changes in texture, subtle hints of bedding. They had become a well-honed field geology team. Just now, Cernan and Schmidt were back on the valley floor near a 1,500-foot diameter crater named for Dr. Zhivago's Lara, and Schmidt was doing what he did at every stop, looking around, sizing up what he saw, and relaying the information to the back room so that they could plan their goals accordingly. "Bob, I'm at the east-southeast rim of a 30-meter crater in the light mantle up on the scarp and maybe 200 meters from the rim of Lara. There's only about a half centimeter of gray cover over very white material that forms the rim." This was a new way of doing business, made possible by the fact that for the first time there was a trained scientist on the moon. But it wasn't long before Schmidt began to lose the upper hand in his mano a mano with the moon. There was too little time for detailed, systematic samples, but while Cernan hammered in a 32-inch-long core tube, Schmidt made his own solo investigations. He made a valiant effort to collect rocks by himself, holding his long-handled scoop in one hand and a Teflon baggie in the other. Every time he tried to set the scoop down, it fell over. Then he knocked over a big collection bag, scattering samples on the ground. Schmidt went down on hands and knees, rounded up the samples, and put them back in the bag. Then he leaned back on his heels to get his massive backpack over his feet and launched himself back to a standing position and dropped the collection bag in the process. Schmidt got down on one knee to retrieve the collection bag, but he stumbled and fell on his chest. At that point, Bob Parker started calling Schmidt Twinkle Toes. Later, he radioed that the switchboard at the manned spacecraft center was lighting up with calls from the Houston Ballet Foundation requesting Schmidt's services for the next season. Seizing the opportunity to audition, Schmidt did a graceful leap and plummeted to the dust, laughing. But that was a temporary setback. Minutes later, as Cernan and Schmidt headed for their next stop at a crater called Shorty, Silver and the rest of the back room were reminded how good their surrogates at Taurus Littro really were. At several points along the traverse, Cernan had stopped driving just long enough to allow Schmidt, still seated, to reach down with a special scoop, which had small bags attached, and collect a sample without getting off the rover. One of these rover samples had been planned while the men drove across the outer portion of the suspected landslide, which the geologist called by the noncommittal name Light Mantle. But at the last minute, Mulberger's team had sent word to cancel it in favor of more time at Shorty. Schmidt and Cernan decided to stop anyway, and it was a fortunate decision. That scoop of light-colored soil would realize one of the geologists' most cherished hopes for Apollo 17. All along, the geologists had suspected that the landslide, this sample helped prove that theory, had been triggered sometime in the distant past by flying debris, ejecta from a distant impact, striking the South Massive. And the impact, they believed, was probably Tycho, 1,300 miles to the southwest. Analyzing the landslide material, the scientists would determine it had been lying on the valley floor for 109 million years, affording a compelling, if not airtight, time for Tycho's formation. In a stroke of incredible good luck, the trip to Taurus Littro appeared to have given the geologists one of the most important dates in lunar history. By exercising their own judgment as trained lunar field geologists, Cernan and Schmidt had beautifully shown their value in the exploration, and this moonwalk wasn't over. 10:18 p.m. Okay, Houston, Shorty is clearly a darker-rimmed crater. The inner wall is quite blocky, and the impression I have of the mounds in the bottom is that they look like slump masses that may have come off the side. Jack Schmidt, about to explore the 360-foot crater, made his report to the back room. On the orbital photos, Shorty was ringed by a dark halo that stood out against the light mantle. The geologists suspected it was a volcanic explosion crater, perhaps one of the sources of the dark mantle deposits. They knew it might well turn out to be just another impact crater, and that the halo was simply an ejecta blanket of dark soil. But the possibility that Shorty might at last reveal evidence of recent volcanism was simply too exciting to ignore. As entertaining as Jack Schmidt's comedy of errors at Lara may have been for those watching on Earth, it had greatly frustrated him. In part, he'd gotten into trouble because he'd had to work alone. He'd practiced a little solo sampling before the flight, but not nearly enough to become efficient, and also he was getting tired. His hands and arms ached too much for him to keep his grip on things. On the drive to Shorty, he had told himself he would forego any more attempts at solo work for a while. Now that he was here, his spirits were lifted by the sight of Shorty itself. The crater was big and deep, its walls littered with rocks, its floor a maze of rubble. The lighting was dramatic, but Schmidt knew he and Cernan would have to work fast. Having spent an extra 10 minutes back at Nansen, they would have only half an hour here. A large, intensely fractured boulder near the crater rim caught Schmidt's eye. Once Cernan was finished with his rover chores, they would sample it. For now, Schmidt would take a panorama from the rim. He moved closer to the boulder and stopped, preparing to take his pictures. Instinctively, he scanned the area around his feet for details, and suddenly he saw that his boots had scuffed away the dust. Instead of the usual monotonous gray, he saw vivid, bright orange. For a moment he wondered whether it was an illusion. At an earlier stop he'd seen a patch of color on the surface that turned out to be a reflection off some gold foil on the rover. He lifted his outer visor partway and looked again. It was real.
"There is orange soil!"
"Don't move it until I see it," said Cernan,
still working at the rover. Privately, he wondered whether Schmidt had been out in the sun a little too long until he turned around.
"Hey, it is! I can see it from here!"
Cernan's voice had risen a full octave.
"It's orange,"
Schmidt said, as if he couldn't believe what he had found. It glowed like a highway sign in the glare of headlights. Cernan wondered aloud,
"How could there be orange soil on the moon?"
Then he answered his own question.
"It's been oxidized."
"Yes," Schmidt agreed, "it looked like the rusted soil you sometimes see in the desert. But if Cernan was right, what had done it? How, on a world devoid of water and air, could there be rust?" The answer was volcanic gases. You can walk around the slopes of the Kilauea volcano in Hawaii, as Cernan and Schmidt had done in training, and see chunks of dark lava that have been turned bright orange, red, or yellow by hot, mineral-laden gases escaping from the depths. At that moment, in the back room, Lee Silver was practically jumping up and down with glee, saying,
"That's it! That's the volcanic vent!"
And Bill Mulberger was saying, "Somebody unplug Silver." Unaware of this ecstatic outburst, Schmidt immediately went to work. First he dug a trench into the orange to find out the extent of the deposit, and he saw that the orange lay along an ellipse-shaped zone that ran parallel to the crater rim. Perfect. The same thing happens in Hawaii. The fractures that allow the gases to percolate upward often follow the perimeter of the volcanic craters, and as a result, so does the pattern of altered soil. Furthermore, the ellipse was divided into zones of color. The orange merged with yellow toward the edges, while in the center the soil was almost crimson. Such zoning, caused by different concentrations of gas, was another hallmark of volcanic action.
"Man, if there ever was a—" Schmidt laughed. "I'm not going to say it."
Yes, he was, even if he turned out to be wrong.
"If I ever saw a classic alteration halo around a volcanic crater, this is it."
When he arrived at Shorty, Schmidt had been all but certain that it was an impact crater. Now there was a very real possibility that Shorty was volcanic. But unless he and Cernan could get an extension, they wouldn't have time to prove it. At the same moment, Lee Silver was telling Jim Lovell, "We need more time." But there wasn't any. The ever-tightening circle of oxygen consumption and walk-back limit was closing in on Cernan and Schmidt. Unlike Nansen, the option for an extension at Shorty simply did not exist. Cernan finished with his rover chores, at last joined Schmidt to collect samples. Schmidt dug his scoop into the orange and found it did not behave like dust. It broke apart in angular fragments. He dropped most of the first scoop before he could pour it into Cernan's sample bag. He told himself to slow down. A second try filled the bag with orange clumps. Then he captured the gray soil at the margins for comparison. The next step, and perhaps the most important, was to find out how deep the deposit went and what might be underneath it. The back room was already thinking about that. Parker passed up a request for a core tube, and at the same time he informed the men that they had 20 minutes left. Cernan drew his hammer. Schmidt watched as he pounded the core as hard as he could. The tube penetrated less than half an inch with each whack.
"I'd offer to hit it," Schmidt said, "but I don't think I can. My hands are so tired."
Cernan persisted and drove the core most of the way in. Thankfully, the core came up without a struggle.
"Even the core tube is red!"
But not all of it. Schmidt was startled to see that the bottom of the tube was coated with dark purple-gray, almost black, soil. For a moment before capping it, the two men cradled the 3-foot core, holding in their hands one of Apollo's most exciting discoveries, as the scientists would realize when it and the other samples were on Earth. Their impact would not be diminished one bit when it became clear that Schmidt had been wrong when he thought Shorty was a volcanic vent, that in fact it was a run-of-the-mill impact crater. The orange soil was anything but ordinary. It was made of tiny beads of glass that had once been molten droplets, poor in silica but rich in titanium and iron, propelled high into the lunar sky by a spectacular form of eruption called a fire fountain. The origin of the fountain was a form of lava that contained dissolved volcanic gases. As it ascended from deep within the moon to the surface, the effect was that of shaking up a bottle of soda and then uncapping it. The gas rapidly came out of solution, propelling molten rock high into the lunar sky, just as water pressure in a decorative fountain causes the liquid to break up into droplets. This so-called fire fountain was composed of an intensely hot spray. In the weak gravity, the droplets arced hundreds or perhaps thousands of feet through the vacuum. During their flight, they cooled into tiny glass spheres, which rained down on the valley of Taurus Littro. Different spheres cooled more slowly than others, affecting their final mineral content. Some of the beads were orange, some were crimson, not from oxidation but due to a high titanium content. Others, many of them, were richer in iron, partially devitrified, that is, crystalline, and colored black. Those beads, which had startled Schmidt when he saw them at the bottom of the core tube, were the answer to the riddle of the dark mantle. The soils of the valley of Taurus Littro, and by implication the southeastern portion of Mare Serenitatis, were dark because they contained beads of dark volcanic glass. But the fire fountains had not sprayed forth recently. As the geologists had hoped, the glass beads were 3.5 billion years old. Untold millions of years later, probably, the deposit had been covered over by a fresh lava flow, which protected the strange beads from being mixed with ordinary lunar soil by micrometeorite rain. They remained hidden for eons, until 19 million years ago, when the Shorty impact excavated them and brought them to the surface, where they awaited the footsteps of a geologist from Earth. And the orange soil discovery would lead the geologists to analyze the beads of green glass from Apollo 15, which would also turn out to have been formed by fire fountains. In both cases, the lava had come from hundreds of miles down in the lunar mantle, far deeper than any other Apollo samples. And on the surfaces of the beads, analysts found coatings of volatile elements, the first such elements found in any lunar samples, which were solid remnants of the original volcanic gases that had powered the eruptions. Knowing that these gases had existed within the moon would cause scientists to revise their models for its evolution. The fact that Schmidt had been wrong when he suspected Shorty was a volcanic crater did not lessen the impact of his work. Despite the fact that Schmidt felt he had barely enough time to think, he and Cernan had performed so well that Mulberger's planning team, after deliberating all night on whether to send the men back to Shorty the next day, decided that would not be necessary. The men had done everything needed to decipher Shorty's story. Schmidt even managed, as the remaining minutes ticked away, to gather pieces of the basalt boulder that had caught his eye to begin with. Meanwhile, Cernan snapped a spectacular series of panoramic pictures, and to his surprise, he spotted streaks of orange and dark gray on the crater walls. He was still trying to tell the back room what he saw, talking so fast that he was almost out of breath when Parker cut him off. "You can talk about it when you get home." 5:12 a.m. Cernan and Schmidt were bedding down for a well-deserved rest when Joe Allen, taking the night shift in mission control, told them that the flight controllers were still marveling at the beautiful television pictures coming down from Taurus Littro. They were fascinated by the footprints and the rover tracks, and they were speculating on what might someday disturb them after Cernan and Schmidt had departed. "That's an interesting thought, Joe," Cernan replied, "but I think we all know that somewhere, someday, someone will be here to disturb those tracks." "No doubt about it, Gino," said Allen. They all knew that the young physicist in mission control would never have the chance himself, but Schmidt felt the need to stress that if it was too late for Joe Allen, there was still reason to be hopeful. "Don't be too pessimistic, Joe. I think it'll happen. Oh, there's no doubt about that, Alan agreed. But it's fun to think about what sort of device will ultimately disturb your tracks.
Well, Schmidt said, that device may look something like your little boy.
Alan laughed, thinking of his 4-year-old son, David. He'd make short work of them.
Cernan was in his hammock now, and Schmidt was about to get into his. They would have their 8 hours' rest, and then would come the final moonwalk. Schmidt took a last look at the earth through the overhead window and rolled the shade closed. He told Alan with gentle irony, "Tomorrow we answer all the unanswered questions, right?"
3. Witnesses to the Earthrise. Wednesday, December 13th, El Lago, Texas. For days now, Jan Evans had ducked outside in hopes of seeing the moon, but instead she saw an impenetrable gray drizzle. Finally, on Wednesday the 13th, a cold front moved in and the sky cleared, and there it was, ripening toward full. Finally, she could see where Ron was. His moon wasn't the one she remembered from her Topeka, Kansas childhood, on those winter nights during World War II when the whole town would turn off its lights during air raid drills. In her living room, her mother had draped a towel over the Philco radio with its big yellow dial. Outside, she could see the air raid warden patrolling the street. The trees were coated with ice, sparkling in the light of a full moon. That would always be her moon, not the one Ron was circling now. She would have loved to be a mouse in the corner, up there with him, if the thought hadn't scared her half to death, and Jan was quite content to listen to the squawk box that brought Ron to her. And she heard a lot of him, because Ron had decided to make a special effort to share his experience with the world as it was happening. Whether the world was listening was an open question. Here at home, the networks were giving Apollo 17 only spotty coverage at best. In New York, the 6th lunar landing made for only a brief interruption to the soap opera Love is a Many Splendored Thing, and the Johnny Mann singers drew more viewers than live images of two explorers on the moon. But that was far from Jan's consciousness. Here in El Lago, with a house full of people and a lawn full of reporters, she was having a ball following her husband's adventures. In between streams of technical jargon, she heard his excited chatter, his humming and whistling. She knew he was very busy, that the flight plan had him running from the moment he awoke until bedtime. On the way out to the moon, Ron had been on watch and had overslept for a solid hour, while Mission Control tried again and again to wake him up. But that was nothing new. Jan told everyone the story of how in the Navy he'd been such a sound sleeper that his bunkmates on the carrier would leave a baby Ben in a metal wash basin right next to his ear. But Ron wasn't oversleeping now, not with all that work to do. At least he was eating well, and that was a good thing, because if there was a chowhound on this crew, it was her husband. Before Jean and Jack had departed, there had been a small crisis when Ron lost his scissors somewhere in the command module, leaving him without any means of opening food bags for 3 days until they got back. They saved him by giving one of their pairs to him, but Jan had a laugh when she learned that on one of his solo days, the flight plan hadn't left him any time for lunch. After the original 19 were selected, Ron had gone to Houston to look for a house, and she could still remember the day he called up and said, "You have to get an air conditioner for the car." She was afraid all this astronaut business had gone to his head. Air conditioning? For the car? On his salary? But the next time he called, he was even more insistent. "I'm not kidding. You've got to get air conditioning." And when she and the children had trekked from San Diego and across most of Texas and arrived in tropical heat, she understood what he meant. Air conditioning was necessary to support human life. Ron was the last person who would let the title of astronaut go to his head. The astronaut life had not been tough on her, the way it had on other wives. From the beginning, she considered it a luxury to have him home on weekends instead of gone for 8 or 9 months at a time, the way he had been when he was serving in Vietnam, and the risk of spaceflight was something she rarely thought about. She had seen the way NASA operated, and she trusted the system. She had come to feel that Ron had been in far greater danger flying missions over the jungle than he was now, a 250,000 miles from home. She knew Ron had always felt that being an astronaut, he had gotten the best deal out of life. She also knew he had friends who had not been so lucky and were at this moment lying in North Vietnamese prisons, and she knew he had always felt a little guilty about that. But he had wanted to fly in space like nothing else she had ever known him to want. It had kept him going for 6 years, through the unglamorous support crew duties of writing checklists, going to meetings, and setting switches before spacecraft tests, through the night shifts in mission control at the Capcom's mic, now that he was up there, and his voice was coming to her from across that amazing distance, he sounded like the same old Ron she had met in high school, except that he was having the time of his life. Jan didn't know the flight plan very well, but she knew the critical phases, things that were essential to carrying out the mission. She followed along when she could, and she got up when Ron got up and went to bed when he did. She was grateful to Deke Slayton, who called every evening to review the day's events with her. "They made a great burn today," he would say, or, "Things are going really well." Looking back later, she would say that Slayton was nothing less than the glue that held the astronaut families together. Aboard the Command Module America in Lunar Orbit. Most of the time, it didn't even feel like flying, except for once when he lit up the SPS engine to change the orientation of his orbit, and he felt the sensation of actually flying a spaceship. It felt like going full afterburner in a T-38. The rest of the time, it was a lovely quiet. His ship was performing flawlessly, and he was proud of it, and what it stood for. He and his crewmates had named their command module America, and to Evans it was the perfect choice. The world should know it was the United States up here, that there was something else his country was giving to history besides a war, something uplifting. During training, Cernan had started calling him Captain America, and if Evans was an unabashed patriot, then he wasn't afraid to say, on the record, that he thought the Nixon administration had paid lip service to the space program without giving any real support, or that the politicians who opposed the program were being swayed by people who thought the money would be better spent on welfare, and he didn't hesitate to call those people kooks. Maybe that kind of outspokenness, almost unheard of among astronauts, came from having risked his neck for his country flying missions over Vietnam. But back then he'd been just another unknown aviator. And if he let his excitement hang out over the airwaves, that was just the way he liked to do things. Why not put aside the image of the cool space traveler? He knew people saw astronauts as reticent. He was changing that. When he wasn't enthusing to Houston, the onboard tape recorder caught him talking up a storm to himself. "What happened to my grits? I lost my grits. There they are again. Anything you drop up here, it just disappears, flat disappears." He was trying to grow a beard for his son, John, but it itched so much he was tempted to shave it off. "Just be comfortable," Ken Mattingly in Houston said. "You got another week to go." It was a long mission. Even now, more than 6 days into it, he was only halfway through, and he was beginning to dislike his own company. "Man, I stink. Woo! Soap doesn't do any good. I'll be glad when the guys get back with the deodorant. Took all the deodorant with them to the surface. Outstanding stuff." Evans made no secret of the fact that he would have liked to walk on the moon, but there was no doubt he meant it when he said that getting within 9 miles was good enough. He was doing his part as Farouk Elbaz's last protege in lunar orbit, and he thought about his crewmates and asked about their progress on the surface. Evans had known Cernan since they were both at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. They'd applied for the astronaut program together, and when Cernan made it, they went out and got drunk together. It had been hard for them to lose Joe Engel, but when Schmidt came on the crew, they made room for him. Evans liked Schmidt well enough, and he gave him a lot of credit for hard work and persistence. Dr. Rock, he called him. And Evans knew that you can take astronauts with the most diverse personalities and put them in the same spacecraft, and they will function as a team because of one thing. The mission comes first. 1:37 p.m. Houston time, 6 days, 16 hours.